Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
All right, so tell me if this has happened to you guys. You're lying in bed at night, and right before you doze off to sleep, you have this thought that right now, tens of millions of people across the country at this exact moment, same as you, are lying down on these rectangular-shaped mattresses and are about to be unconscious for the next 8 hours while having hallucinations. Because that's what sleep is when you think about it. And when you think about it that way, sleep's kind of weird. And it's kind of weird that we sleep the way we do. I think we take it for granted that you sleep from, you know, about 10 until 8 or so, if you wake up late. But our guest today makes the case that this hasn't always been the case, and that for most of human history, sleep has actually been very unique to communities and to individuals. And it wasn't until about the 19th century, until the whole world basically got on this sleep schedule where you sleep from 10 o'clock at night till about 7 o'clock in the morning, then you work during the day, no naps, and then you repeat the process. Before then, sleep was much more individualistic, it was unique to different communities, and it's this whole radical transformation of sleep has had profound changes, effects on the way we approach life, work, and sleep. Our guest is named Matthew Wolfmeyer. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's the author of a very fascinating book called The Slumbering Masses, and it's basically a cultural study, an anthropological look at sleep and why we sleep the way we do. In this podcast, we discuss when the transformation to sleep as we know today happened. We discuss the medicalization of sleep, and all the things we do to improve our sleep with over-the-counter medications, but also the things we use to jolt ourselves awake so we can stick to this work schedule that we have, either through coffee, tea, now energy drinks. Anyways, fascinating discussion. I think you really like it. And we even get into what you can do if you have a sleep schedule where it just doesn't fit with the norm, right? The working norm or the school schedule, what you can do to work with that. So great discussion. Think you'll get a lot of out of it. Without further ado, Matthew Wolfmeyer and the Slumbering Masses. Matthew Wolfmeyer, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So your book, The Slumbering Masses, is a book about sleep, but it's different from a lot of the books that have come out about sleep in the past 10 years, I'd say, where it's all had about how to get better sleep, the science of sleep. Your book is like a cultural study of sleep and the sociology of sleep. What made you want to research the anthropology of sleep in America?
Uh-huh. So it depends how far back you want to go. I mean, and we'll probably talk about a lot of the stuff as we go, but I was always a problem sleeper. So like as a kid, throughout middle school and high school, I had pretty, what I thought were abnormal sleeping times, like going to sleep really late, having to wake up for school, needing to take naps during the day. And then when I was in college, it gave me the opportunity to tailor a schedule sort of around my sleep. And what ended up happening was I got a job working third shift. So I worked from like 10 p.m. until 8 a.m., which was okay with me. And then I would go to school from 8 until 10 o'clock in the morning, and then go to school from like 5 until 8 o'clock at night. And that all totally worked. And And at the time, I had a bunch of coworkers who just could not handle the schedule. And whenever they were off work, like on their weekends, they would end up trying to sleep like everybody else did. And it was like a decade later, as I started to do the research, that I realized how bad of an idea that actually is. But at the time, I was always kind of attuned to different kinds of sleeping. And I always really enjoyed, this was in Metro Detroit, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, just being able to step out into the middle of a otherwise very busy street and seeing the world kind of sleeping around me and being like the one person that was awake. And so when it came time to actually develop a research project much later, I had initially thought that what I was going to do is write a book about night work. So not just people kind of doing factory work in the middle of the night, but like all of the stuff that happens at night in order to make society work throughout the day. So security guards and police, ambulance drivers, nurses, ER doctors, sanitation workers, construction workers. I thought that I would just tell this kind of big story about labor at night. And in my initial idea about that project, I thought that I would write one chapter that would be about what everybody else was doing. And so everyone else would be sleeping. The way that I would get into that would be going to a sleep clinic. Just by sheer happenstance, there was a piece in the New York Times Magazine profiling a sleep center near where I was a graduate student. And so I got in touch with the director, and they invited me over for lunch one day and kind of gave me the tour. And probably within 10 minutes of being there, I thought like, oh, this is the real project. Like I can do everything that I want to do just by talking about sleep in American society. And they were all the doctors and the researchers that I was spending time with there were all really interested in having an anthropologist hang out with them. Like they had a bunch of questions and they thought that I didn't know the answer to any of their questions at the time, but they figured that they could task me with answering the questions that they had. And so it was just kind of off to the races from that point. Like that, as soon as I got into it, I was like, oh, obviously this is the project. And the other thing, like you kind of mentioned in the intro, nobody's written this book, right? That like, if you look at the literature out there, there's a lot of kind of self-helpy stuff. There's a lot of popular science books that are like, this is why we sleep. Although nobody actually really knows why we sleep, but they have it. And stuff written by scientists, right? So there's a bunch of books by scientists about sleep, but they're really uncritical, right? They accept sleep as it is, right? And so I figured there's a huge window here that I guess needs to be jumped through. And I was the guy who jumped through that window.
Very good. So one of the main points you make in the book is Americans today sort of take for granted our current sleeping schedule. We all assume that since time immemorial, people have went to bed between the hours of 10, around then, and they woke up at 7 or so, by 7, to go to work. But you make the case that, well, no, that's not how sleep was until about the 19th century. So what was sleep like before this sort of what's called consolidated sleep, right? The 8 hours.
One of the things that got me started on the project was this book written by a historian named Roger Ekirch called At Day's Close. And at the end of that book, he writes a chapter about basically a hypothesis that he has that people before industrialization slept in what we now refer to as a biphasic model. And he was looking at the UK and some historical documents that he had. And what he was hinting at is that people would go to sleep around sundown. They would sleep for a few hours. They'd wake up in the middle of the night for a period that could be anywhere between like an hour and 4 hours. Then they would go back to sleep and then wake up around dawn to go to work. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because it's not like nighttime is 8 hours long. And even if it, even if it is some of the time, it's not consistently 8 hours long, nor is it 8 hours long everywhere around the world all the time, right? So the idea that sleep and darkness are necessarily tied together is just wrong on the face of it, right? And when you think about the availability of electric light, people, like especially the working classes, don't have cheap, accessible electric light, in some cases until after the turn of the 20th century, right? So you have, so there's that set of circumstances. So I started to look at the historical record in the United States, and particularly the medical monographs and medical pamphlets and medical articles that are published kind of at the end of the 1700s through the 1800s. And what people are identifying is exactly this pattern of sleep, right? That people are going to sleep around sundown, they sleep for a few hours, wake up, go back to sleep. And they sometimes refer to it as first sleep and second sleep, or first nap and second nap, first slumber, second slumber, that kind of thing. And the reason why they're talking about it is because it's a problem for the new industrial work schedule. And so historically what's happening is that people are moving from the countryside, where they're working either on their family farm, somebody else's family farm, or in a trade that's probably owned by someone that they know very intimately because they're living in small settings, to big urban centers where they're one of thousands of strangers working in a factory for somebody that they have no relationship to, right? And so in their old work situations, work times vary. If you need to take a nap, you can probably take a nap. If you need to go home early because there's an emergency, no problem. But when you're working for a large factory where everybody's anonymous, any of those kinds of variances are fireable offenses, right? And there's a long line of people just waiting to take those jobs. So people are put into these consolidated work days that are structured by the availability of free sunlight, right? So electric light's not available for most of these factories. There's some gas lighting, but generally the way the factories are operating is they open at dawn, they close at dusk, and there's one shift, and everybody works from dawn until dusk. And so what happens to people's sleep is that they're so exhausted at the end of the day that they consolidate their sleep. And so the idea of consolidated sleep is really something that's based on a new model of exhaustion. So if you were working in a way where you could take a nap whenever you needed to, you're never as exhausted as you are when you have to stay awake for 16 hours at a stretch, right? And so what happens in the medical literature is all these doctors are identifying the biphasic model as being a problem. They start to refer to it as insomnia, and they start to think about ways to treat that problem, right? There's a lot of scare tactics involved, too, that they're really trying to shame people away from sleeping in a biphasic way. And so you really see from basically the beginning of American medicine and American industrial capitalism, this tie between medicine and capitalism around shaping what workers are supposed to do and how they operate. The thing is that that consolidated model of the workday links up with the consolidated model of the school day, right? So for the working classes, what do you do with your kids? You have to send them somewhere. So the state basically steps in and gives public education to the working classes in a way that had never been available before. And so kids are going to school at the same time that their parents are at work. And so you slowly see over the course of the 19th century, all of these institutions that we kind of take for granted in American social life abiding by the same set of ideas about time. And so by the turn of the 20th century, and this is really the beginning of sleep science as a science, the earliest guy, whose name is Nathaniel Kleitman, and he's a professor of physiology at the University of Chicago, he's starting to do research on sleep, and his assumption is that people sleep in consolidated way, Right. So he's carrying it into the basis of the science, and he's not allowing napping or variations in sleeping schedules. It's really what you're testing is consolidated sleep. And so what happens is he develops a model of our circadian rhythms that's based on consolidated sleep rather than biphasic sleep. And that's the model of circadian rhythms that everybody uses to this day, basically. So we really don't know what human sleep would look like outside of the context of sort of industrial capitalism and the structure around time.
Yeah, I want to get back to that, your point about insomnia and sleep disorder, because I think that's really interesting. What I found fascinating in your book is that you point out that the way we sleep is primarily economically and productivity driven. You made the interesting point how Ben Franklin was one of the early guys who, you know, early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And one of his reasons he kind of advocated for consolidated sleep was that it saved money on candles, right? Like,
right.
Yeah. He went to France and he saw that they wasted all this, you know, this candle wick, you know, partying and carousing in the night, and they didn't get up in the day to go, you know, be productive. He said, well, no, if they just slept 8 hours, they would save on candles.
Right. And if they just slept when it's dark rather than having to use the light, everything, right? And the great thing about that essay of his is that he does the math to figure out how much it costs to burn something like 40,000 candles a week, right? Which, like, is an insane amount of candles, right? But if you're a French aristocrat, apparently that's what you do.
So, this consolidated sleep model we take for granted, and it was because of cultural and economic changes in America, going from an agrarian to an industrial economy. And you make the point that this American way of sleeping has spread to other countries. Can you talk a little bit about how our idea of sleeping has spread across the world?
So in two ways, primarily. So first, like I was just talking about in the science, what happens is scientific models that are invented in the United States get exported elsewhere. And so you would think that societies where there's long-standing napping traditions, like Spain and their siesta culture, like China, like Taiwan, like Italy, that they would have sleep scientists working under different assumptions. But in fact, they just buy into the American model whole hog. And so it really shapes the science and medicine of sleep around the world. And secondarily, it's structured around ideas around capitalist work time, right? So recently, maybe not that recently anymore, 10 years ago, in the early stages of the European Union, Spain came under a lot of fire, in part from conservative movements within Spain about getting rid of the siesta so that they would be more productive, like Germany and France and England. And so what they do in order to make that happen is they pass laws that all state agencies, like the Postal Service, only operates between 9 and 5 o'clock, right? So everybody else has to sync up to that time. And so we see that kind of synchronization pressure happen in a variety of ways. One of the things that I was really interested in is the synchronization between like the United States and call centers in India and the Philippines too, right? And so what we've exported to them in order to harness their labor is our calendar and our work week. So they get synced up in a kind of inverted way to our work time so that they're awake while we're awake, right? And they're asleep while everybody else in their society is awake, right? And they abide by our holidays and, you know, like the structure of how, and so like our work week, if you look at how it maps onto their work week, is hours different, right? And yet they're working on their Sundays in order to be available on our Mondays, right? So there's really pervasive and sort of subtle ways that our ideas about sleep have kind of structured other societies.
So going back to that, this idea of sleeping disorders, because before sleep science, there really wasn't such as there really wasn't sleep disorders, right? Mm-hmm. Insomnia didn't really exist because people were in a biphagic model. So, and you make the point in the book or the case that sleeping disorders aren't so much they are a health issue, but they're also a social problem. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that drives people to sleep centers and to medication. So can you explain that a little bit? How are sleep disorders social problems?
So one really quick thing that, like, we actually have pretty good descriptions of a lot of the sleep disorders that goes back at least to 1820. So there's a Scottish physician named Robert McNish who writes this book called The Philosophy of Sleep, where he is basically coming up with descriptions for insomnia and narcolepsy and drowsiness of various kinds. And he basically gets written out of the history of sleep science and medicine. I'm not entirely sure why. But I think part of it is that there, by the conditions of the 1820s, all of these kinds of medical experiences are very, very rare. And it's not until the 1840s and really the 1880s that something like insomnia is something that's generalizable to broad swaths of the population, right? And, you know, that medicine is more and more available to people more broadly. But in terms of the kind of like how are sleep disorders social disorders, probably, you know, the best examples are the ones that are about like schedules for sleep interfering with schedules for work or for school. And so, for example, one of the stories that I often tell, and I'll tell again, is that at the sleep clinic, they would often see adolescents or teenagers who had problems waking up for public school time. So they couldn't get to school by 7:30 in the morning. It was probably more like 10 o'clock. And so what they had done is figured out what the school start times for all of the schools in the area were. They would figure out what a individual student would wake up around and what kind of sleep need they would need. And they would recommend them to particular schools, right? So there were a bunch of kids who couldn't wake up until 10 o'clock in the morning that all went to Catholic school, despite not being Catholic, because it fit their sleep schedule, right? And the alternative is that like you end up having to wake up to go to school at 7:30 and you're a teenager who needs Provigil or something else in order to stay awake, or drink coffee or whatever. And that like your sleeping problem is really a kind of mismatch between your biological desire for sleep and the institutional times that are normative, right? And so if we just had different institutional times or even flexible institutional times, then you would see far fewer sleep disorders in society, which doesn't mean that like narcolepsy would go away. There are like very clear biological conditions that lead to narcolepsy, and it's always a challenge, but like you could have more tolerant institutions that would allow people to be sleepy at all sorts of different times of the day.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's INDOCHINO.com. Promo code manliness. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. There's a famous Abraham Lincoln quote that goes something like, "Good things come to those who wait." That's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. Thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you can find qualified candidates fast. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/manliness to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. I want to get back to that, what we can do about our different sleeping schedules and trying to fit into work and school. But yeah, you also make the point that in the past 10 years, there's been this proliferation of medications to get us awake and to put us to sleep. And so a lot of people are on this vicious cycle where they'll take an energy drink to wake up, or a pot of coffee. And then at night, and then they keep drinking during the day, so they stay awake. And then at night, they take some sort of medicine to help them fall asleep. Right. So and what's going on there? Is this something that's just recent, or was this something that started, you know, a century ago or decades ago?
This seems pretty recent. Like, it seems like a real intensification of things that have been happening for a long time. So it's not like it's totally new, but the intensity of it is pretty new. So one of my favorite books that I'll plug is called Sweetness and Power by an anthropologist named Sidney Mintz. And the story that he tells is that industrialization in Europe really depends on exporting sugar and coffee and tea from the Caribbean in order to keep workers awake throughout the day, right? And so, like, the idea of tea time in Britain is really based on this idea that, like, you could either take a nap or you drink some caffeine at that point in the day, right? And that we've lost taking those naps and accepted having some caffeine in the afternoon in order to stay awake for the rest of the workday, right? And and so, you know, coffee or caffeination really and sugar have always been tied to labor as we know it. But the way that we're medicalizing sleep and kind of alertness these days is much more intense, right? So you can just think about the widespread popularity of Starbucks, right? That like 20 years ago, there were not coffee shops the way that there are now, right? Mm-hmm. And now there's Starbucks everywhere, right? That this like incitement to always be caffeinated is something that's really pervasive, right? And so if you look at the numbers about people who have problems sleeping at night, something like a third of Americans, the numbers change a little bit, but it's about like a third to almost a half of Americans complain about problems falling to sleep or staying asleep in any given year, right? That people have at least intermittent insomnia. And so, you know, there's more and more people who are using off-label sleep aids, so like Tylenol PM, right, rather than Lunesta or Ambien or something like that, or NyQuil, which is a terrible idea, right? But that, you know, there are a variety of ways that people are helping themselves get to sleep and also keeping themselves awake throughout the day, right? And it becomes this kind of vicious cycle, because if you're taking more and more Ambien, you need more and more coffee to offset the debt that you're kind of accruing, the sleep, what's sometimes referred to as sleep drunkenness, that you wake up and you're still kind of sleepy, so you need more and more coffee, right? And there can be, there's stories in the book about, there's one guy who reports to his sleep doctor that he drinks something like 4 pots of coffee a day.
Like, it's like 5 pots, yeah.
But like, you know, that's like 16 cups of coffee a day, right? And that, you know, that's a profound amount of caffeine to be putting into your system.
Yeah.
But the assumption is that like we need to do it in order to meet the work needs that we have, right? So the alternative might be that, you know, you have workplace napping, right? That like instead of having, you know, coffee free for everybody, that you give people a place to go take a nap. And there's some workplaces that have experimented with that. But the big problem that they run into is that people don't want to be the napper, right? Like they don't want to be the guy who's sleeping at his desk. Or in some cases, what they'll do is they'll take an office and turn it into a napping space. And so you don't want to be the guy that's, you know, going into the napping space or coming out of the napping space. And so a lot of the people that I talk to about napping at work, they're like, you know, I just like will get in my car, go to the nearest fast food place and, you know, sleep in the parking lot, right? Like rather than have my coworkers see me sleep. And so there's really like, we need an attitude shift about sleeping in some respects.
Yeah, I think it's funny about NyQuil is that they have Z-Quil now. Because they just realized, oh, everyone's just taking this to go to sleep. They don't really have they don't have the flu or the cold. So let's just make something with alcohol and, you know, whatever that drug is that makes you sleepy.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting with the nap thing in businesses, that's sort of becoming a thing. And it's not because, you know, businesses are like, they want to take care of their employees. They want it. They're doing it for productivity, right? I think it's kind of ironic, you know, decades ago, they're like, no napping. You need to work. Be productive. And now they're saying, oh, well, yeah, nap, because you're going to be more productive and we can get more out of you.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the weird, the paradox of it, right? Is that like, you as an employee might really want to take a nap, but what employers have discovered is that if you take that nap, they'll get way more labor out of you for free, right? So if you're a salaried employee, by 5 o'clock, you just want to go home, right? If you take a nap at 2:30 and you wake up at 3, you're good until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, right? Maybe even later than that. And so a lot of businesses realize that they can get more work out of people just by giving them a nap allowance, pretty much. And so I had also talked to a bunch of people at a law firm where they had a napping facility, and they all realized that they were self-exploiting, right? That like they had started staying later and later, and they collectively decided to stop using the napping facilities, right? That like they just wanted to go home. And so there is this kind of like, damned if you do, damned if you don't around the workplace stamp.
Yeah. So and besides using medication for off-label uses, you know, Tylenol PM or NyQuil, to go to sleep, there's also a lot of entrepreneurs, you're reading about this a lot, entrepreneurs, business executives, you know, high-powered attorneys who are taking very powerful stimulating drugs that, you know, that are used for people who have, you know, severe sleep disorders, like Provigil or Modafinil. Not because they don't have a problem with sleep or waking up, it's just like they just want to stay awake longer so they can get more work done. Have you looked into that sort of like, there's like a cult of Modafinil on the internet.
Yeah. And, you know, students talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
Like in among my students, I've seen over the last 10 years, total ignorance to Provigil, to widespread knowledge about it and sometimes use of it, right? That like Ritalin drugs, you know, so for a long time, only people with Ritalin use those drugs. And now it's like, well, everybody does it during exams, right? And, you know, there's a lot of people who swear by Provigil and the new version of it, which is called Nuvigil. You know, it's used by the military to keep people awake for a while. It's expensive, you know, like and I think one of the real challenges around it is that what we see in the kind of off-label pharmaceuticalization of everyday life is that, you know, some of these things are available to certain classes of people and they're not available to other classes of people, right? And so, you know, sure, if you're an elite business person, you can get your doctor to write you a prescription for a Nuvigil, but most of us don't have access to that, right? And so instead, we drink a bunch of caffeine to keep up with people who are using that kind of drug. Nobody really knows what the long-term effects of drugs like that are, though.
It's only been out for, you know, like 10 years or so, right?
Yeah, you know, and so even the military has kind of backed away from using it quite so much because they're not sure what the effects of it are going to be. And, you know, it's a new kind of stimulant for the central nervous system. And, you know, there's some doubts about what its effects will be. So, you know, in some cases, what people might be doing is getting some kind of gain in the short term, but really facing neurological problems in the long term. And we just kind of have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, speaking of sort of like this sort of division between individuals who can afford drugs to keep them awake and be super productive and individuals who can't, let's talk about like the future of sleep. I mean, you kind of allude to this a little bit in your book, and no one really knows what the future of sleep, but it seems like there's this push to end sleep, right, amongst a certain group of people so they can be super productive all the time. What is the future of sleep? Is that going to happen? Are we going to genetically modify ourselves where we don't need sleep anymore?
Yeah, I think the future of sleep is to keep asking about the future of sleep.
Yeah,
right. You know that, and it's one of the things that I track in the book that, like, you know, people have been asking about the future of sleep since at least the turn of the 20th century. Right?
That's how it always goes.
Yeah. And, you know, so like there's early stuff about like, how do you maximize your sleep? Like, can you learn a foreign language in your sleep?
Yeah.
Which, you know, you still see people talking about, can you learn while you're sleeping? Not really. Can we get rid of sleep altogether? Probably not. You know, that if you think about life on Earth, everything sleeps, right? So plants sleep, every other animal species sleep, we sleep. And, you know, we're not entirely sure what sleep does. We do know it has some pretty important effects on like our memory and our ability to learn new things, our stress levels, you know, so if you're not sleeping really well, you get stressed out way more easy. And so, you know, the question might be like, if we get rid of sleep, at what cost, right? Mm-hmm. So like, chances are if we get rid of sleep, we're not going to be the humans that we are today. We're going to look very different, right? And so there's a book series by Nancy Kress called Beggars in Spain, where they do genetically modify humans to get rid of sleep. And her presumption is that, like, when you lose sleeping, you lose basically creative potential, right? That, like, there's something about sleeping and dreaming that's really important to our ability to create and even kind of be human. And so the people who get rid of sleep in her world are just, like, cold, calculating computer people, yeah. Right? And so, you know, that might index a sort of anxiety about, like, what we would actually be losing when we lose sleep. That being said, you know, the future of sleep might be tinkering with it more, right? And so one of the scientists I find really interesting is this Italian guy named Claudio Stampi, who is a yacht racer, and he does these experiments on what he refers to as ultra short sleep. So it's basically catnapping for humans, that, like, you're awake for a short period, you go to sleep for a short period, you're awake for a short period. So you don't have long sleeping periods.
It's like polyphagic sleep, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so you can, I think it's still online. There's this Frontline episode, I think, that he was on. And you can find this footage of him running this experiment with an undergraduate where the kid has to wake up, do a performance test every 2 hours, then he goes back to sleep. And after about 30 days, it's just getting harder and harder for this kid to wake up. But in the end, you know, he's pretty groggy when he does get up, but he can still actually get through his performance tests pretty well. Which points to, you know, this idea that maybe we could organize sleep differently, right? That, like, the 24-hour society might not be everybody being awake all the time, but it might be that, you know, some people are going to be able to organize their work in ways that are different than this kind of consolidated work and sleep period.
Yeah. Didn't Kramer on Seinfeld, like, do an experiment with that? Like,
yeah,
it didn't work out for him.
Yeah, they call it the, like, it's how Leonardo da Vinci apparently slept, yeah. Which is, it's something like half an hour every 4 hours.
Yeah.
Something like that, right? And it really doesn't work out for Kramer.
Doesn't work out for him. And yeah, the whole idea of, like, getting rid of sleep, like, if they did, I don't know what I would do with myself, honestly, right? It's like, I would be bored out of, I mean, one of the reasons I enjoy sleep is, like, it takes up time when I have nothing else going on.
Well, that's the thing, that you know, like, I love my family.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time together already.
Sure.
And the prospect of spending 8 more hours a day with my 4-year-old son is a crazy prospect, right? And so if we did get to the point where we were awake all the time, we would have to really restructure what society looks like.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it doesn't mean that we would have 8 hours of recreation. We would probably be finding other ways to organize what we're doing.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I kind of mean, that, like, if we get rid of sleep, we're not going to be the human beings that we are today, right? That, like, everything is going to change if we got rid of sleep.
So I don't know. I think your book came out right before, like, the uptick in, like, tracking devices where you can track your steps, and there's even a device where you can track your sleep. It's this whole quantified self thing. So this idea of being able to track not only how many hours you sleep, but your quality of sleep. I even bought one of those, like, Zio things, like, you strap it to your head and, like, it reads your brain waves. Does this sort of entrench people more into the idea that, okay, you need to sleep, you know, 8 hours straight or 9 hours, or does it give people information where they can start tinkering and with their own sleep schedule?
I think it does both, right? Okay. And so the thing that I would point to is that, you know, there are cultural assumptions embedded in all of this technology, right? So if the technology really assumes that consolidated sleep is the only way that you're getting good sleep, then it's probably a problem. If the technology is a little more flexible and is able to work with whatever kind of sleep schedule you want to work towards, then it might be a little more liberatory, right? And so, like, one of the things that I tell people to do, and this is based on clinical practice, is that, like, if you really want to figure out what kind of sleeper you are, you need probably about 2 weeks of not waking up to an alarm clock, right? And so, like, what the project is that you go to sleep when you're tired, you time how long you go to sleep for, you are awake when you're awake, right? And you, you know, maybe you have a cup of coffee, right? But you don't drink lots of caffeine. You also don't drink a lot of alcohol or anything like that. You're just trying to isolate what your sleep is actually like, right? And so what one of the things that you can discern by doing that is what an actual sleep period is. So if you look at what the physiology of sleep is, you have these roughly 2 hour periods of moving through the different stages of sleep. And so our sleep is always kind of built up of a certain number of those periods, right? So when we talk about consolidated sleep, what we're thinking about is 4 of those periods kind of smashed together. But because the 2 hour number is pretty soft, like it can be anywhere between an hour and a half or 3 hours that a sleep period is. And you always want to be sleeping in factors of that period, right? So like, if you've got a technology that helps you figure out what your sleep period actually is and is helping you kind of abide by a factor of those periods, then you're probably using that technology pretty well, or it's decent technology, right? If you're being shamed by your technology because you're not sleeping 8 hours a night, that's a problem, right?
Yeah. I think the Zio does that because like it'll give you a sleep score. And like give you suggestions, like you need to do this, like to improve your sleep. I'm like, okay, I will do that algorithm.
Yeah, right. And so like the other thing, like the apps on your phone that like are supposed to monitor how well you're sleeping by putting it under your pillow, Probably not worth the money, right? That like. Even it's called actigraphy technology, and it's a bracelet that people put on in order to clinically track their movements. And so you can look at somebody's actigraphy report to see when they're awake and when they're asleep, pretty much, right? But if you're a really active sleeper, it's a bad technology for you, right? And if you sit at a desk all day and you don't move your left arm very much, It's also a bad technology.
Yeah, right? That's happened to me with the Fitbit. Like, I'll be like on, you know, sitting writing for, you know, 2 hours, and they'll say, "You were taking a nap." I was like, "No, I wasn't. I was writing."
Right. Okay. And so I think that's, you know, that's one of those things that people always need to think about, like, what is the cultural assumption embedded in this technology, right? And I'm a little, the whole quantified self stuff, I'm a little skeptical of more broadly because it really is emphasizing these ideas about productivity, right? And I think that, you know, ideas about being productive are ways that we tie ourselves to self-exploitation, right? That, like, if all we're thinking about is whether or not we're being productive, like, we have sold out to the system.
Sold your soul. So, I mean, here's the question. I know your book is primarily descriptive and it's not prescriptive, but and you've kind of alluded to this a bit, what people can do, but what if you have a sleep schedule that just doesn't fit the norm? What can you do? And do you think technology is giving us more flexibility in how we work and how we school that will allow us to, I don't know, change our schedule so it fits our personal sleep schedule?
For some people, yes, right? That like one of the... So one of the recommendations that I make is that we need to think about flex time for all of the institutions that we interact with, right? So some workplaces have this idea that you can come into work late and work late, right? Or you can take a day off and make that day up some other way, right? And that flexibility in the schedule is something that historically has really been for the most elite workers, right? And But it provides us a model for thinking about how we might structure institutional time across different kinds of workplaces, within schools especially. I think having that model in schools would be great. But you can also think about it related to, you know, family and recreation and stuff like that, that like we need a little more flexibility in order to address the different styles of sleep that people have. And the challenge in that kind of recommendation is that it, you know, it's really, because it's so tied to elite labor in the past, it's difficult to get other kinds of labor on board with that schedule, right? So if we want to pick on Starbucks, right, that like, because it's a low paying job, they're going to give you the hours that they can give you. If you can't work those hours, you're just going to get fired. Right. And so what, you know, what we might need to think about is the kind of like careful management of a work population, right? So if you find workers that are good in the morning and bad at night, then you schedule them in the morning and you schedule all the other workers at night. Right. And it depends on kind of taking seriously people's variation in sleep and how it might actually fit into scheduling more generally, right? You know, I think for like the so-called creative class, technology makes things a lot easier, right? That we can telecommute all the time, or you can work kind of flexible hours. But, you know, the real question is, what do we do with everybody else, right? Because everybody else are also the people who have the worst health insurance, and they're probably most likely to self-medicate through ZQL or alcohol or amphetamines or whatever else, right? So if you really want a kind of equitable society, we need to think about how we arrange school time and work time and family time in a way that's in some ways agreeable to everybody, right? And so instead of having this static schedule, we need to think about what can we actually do in order to make it a little more livable.
Interesting. Well, Matthew Wolfmeyer, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Brett. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Our guest today is Matthew J. Wolfmeyer. He is the author of the book, The Slumbering Masses. You can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.